Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. I'm Garima Gurk. I'm here to talk about the book The Eleventh Mile of Things, translated by Roman Ivashkin and Sabrina Jasti. The original works are by Andriy Fedomora, who is a prominent writer, translator, and professor in Ukraine. Hi, Roman. Hi, Sabrina. Thank you so much for being here. How are you doing today?
Hi, Garima. We're doing well. Thank you.
Can you share a bit about yourselves and what brought you together to work on this book?
Sure. So my name is Roman Ivashkiv, and I teach Slavic languages and literatures at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. I also am a huge fan of literary translation and translation studies more broadly. And so far, this project, so the Mona translation, has been the biggest project I've completed.
And I'll say something about myself. So my name is Sabrina Yassi, and I'm a literary translator, mostly from Russian and Uzbek. And I am the co-founder of a translation collective and journal called Turkoslavia that focuses on Slavic and Turkic language literatures. I'm also a scholar of Central Asian studies. I'm currently finishing my PhD at UC Berkeley in the Slavic department. And previously I was a librarian of Slavic and Central Asian resources. And I initially met Roman at University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, where I was working as a librarian and he was teaching. And we were united by our shared interest in translation. And then several years later, Roman approached me with this project and I joined him to translate it.
Right. So, that brings me to, you know, a very important point, you know, translation as a literary process. So Andriy Fedomora has spoken quite a bit about, you know, translation and the difficulties of it or the wonders of it. So this book is a translation as well. So can you share your views about the importance of translation in this context? Like, how much do you think a work can be translated? How much depth can be found in it? And what amount remains untranslatable, you know, from the original work to the, you know, translated work?
Sure. So yeah. That's a big question. That's a loaded question. But I think maybe I'll share my views on the translation process briefly, and then Sabrina will elaborate, if that's okay. So for me, translation has always been a fascinating process, but also a paradoxical one. And I kind of make this point a lot when I teach literary translation. I taught a course in applied literary translation at the University of Illinois. And so I always tried to underscore this to my students. Why is it paradoxical? For several reasons. First of all, it's paradoxical because it's a twofold act of reading and writing. And as Gayatri Chakravarti Spivak aptly put it, it's probably the closest act of reading, but it doesn't stop there, because readers may, even the most, the sharpest readers, the closest readers may think that, oh, I read into every layer of the text and, you know, into everything that's in it, and I unpacked it. But then translation doesn't stop there. So then you have to create your own text based on your interpretation of the original. And that complicates things, okay? But also it's paradoxical because the act of translation is premised to a large extent on this dichotomy, which is sameness and difference. And the expectation is always about sameness, like, oh, how are you going to create the same text or as similar as possible to the original with all the problematic concepts of faithfulness and equivalence, which I kind of hate a little bit. But then people oftentimes forget that sameness is a little bit of a utopia because everything that we do in translation is actually based on difference. So we work with different languages and different cultures. That's the easy part. But we also work in different temporal and spatial contexts, with different political contexts, with different sensibilities, and different readers, most importantly. And so this brings us to all of the problems and all of the challenges in translation. So on the one hand, you do want to be as faithful to the original author, but what does it even mean being faithful to the original author? Intentions, other things are problematic. So, you know, you kind of want to be faithful to your own interpretation of the original text. You also want to be faithful to language. You want to be faithful to art. But in case of Sodomora, you know, it's kind of easy to theorize this faithfulness. Oh, you know, we're just got to be creative and spontaneous and all that. But in case of Sodomora, you do feel the pressure a little bit of being faithful and being ethical to the text because of what he is and what he stands for. And maybe I will talk a little bit more about this later. But you do feel like, oh my gosh, you know, Sodomora is so important in Ukraine. And you kind of also feel the pressure from the text, like there's so much in it and you want to do it justice. And so this is why the process of translation is extremely challenging here. One last thing that I would add to this is that translation is also a creative and spontaneous process, but also a collaborative one. And I'm just absolutely convinced that there's no way I could have done this on my own, or anybody else could have done this on their own. So that's why I feel like this collaboration that I have with my good friend and colleague, Sabrina, has been productive and successful just because we bring different things to the table. And it was only possible, in fact, through this collaboration. I'll stop here.
Yeah, and I'll just add a few things. First of all, just reiterating Roman's point that each translation really is a version of the original. You can't think of it as a copy or a replica of the original, but it's really the translator's interpretation of what that text means to them. And it really became clear to me through translating this work that was the case, because a lot of the time my grasp of Ukrainian is definitely not as strong as Roman's, who is a first language speaker of Ukrainian. And so oftentimes I would have to have Roman explain to me the meaning of a certain phrase. And even once he explained it, we would still sort of go back and forth and debate about the meaning. But for me, the goal was always to reach some sort of cohesive understanding of the text so that there are no mysteries, at least to us or between us, about what Sodomora was trying to say. Because my feeling was always that if I don't understand what he's trying to say down to the last detail, how is the reader going to understand it? So obviously we strove for accuracy as much as possible, but in certain cases, I think it is excusable to take some liberties if it's for the sake of sort of general cohesion and you're bringing together the larger meaning, even if the individual details do not line up precisely with what's written in Ukrainian.
Right. So Sodomora is also very much interested in antiquity, since, you know, he's the translator of classical Greek and Roman works. And I read an interview of his where he spoke about antiquity, you know, as something that is eternal, like, you know, the idea that were present in the Greek times and Roman times are still relevant. And so how do you think this book, Tears and Smiles of Things, reflects that, you know, interest of his, that perspective of his, you know, about antiquity?
That's a great question. Sodomora, we say this in our introduction, Sabrina and I do, in the book. Sodomora has been the Ukrainian voice of classical antiquity for several decades now. And The guy is just phenomenal. His aura is just astounding. He translated whole works of ancient Greek and Roman writers whose names we've seen in anthologies and whose excerpts we read in like Horton Anthology and stuff like that. But the guy has ingested all of this and he's been working on it for his entire life. And so when he started writing his own fiction, I can't precisely pinpoint when, but you know, over the last maybe 2 decades when he started producing more of his own stuff, of course, all of his own creative work has been steeped in classical antiquity. But interestingly, it's not like, you know, I don't think it's didactic in a bad way, in the sense that he's like pulling, you know, quotes from Horace or Virgil or Ovid or somebody else and just kind of inserting them into his stories. He incorporates them so masterfully that it feels extremely natural, but also extremely illuminating. So when you read him, you're just kind of impressed and, in fact, overwhelmed oftentimes with what he has to offer and how he incorporates all of this kind of ancient wisdom that he's been accumulating over the years into his own, you know, fiction, into his own short stories. And so one problem that this created for Sabrina and for myself is that we had to do a lot of research. We could not take the approach of like translating or quoting Greek and Roman authors or referring to Greek and Roman literature based on the Ukrainian original. We had to look those texts up in English. And there we also had to deal with like translation multiplicity and all sorts of challenges that English translators from Greek and Roman literatures faced when they produced their own English versions of whatever text, you know, the Aeneid or Odyssey or any other, or, you know, Horace's poetry. And so those quotations had to be researched carefully to make sure that, you know, there's many versions, but then which version aligns more closely with what Sotomora does in Ukrainian, and given the fact that Sotomora himself translated all of this stuff into Ukrainian. So that created another, you know, I don't want to say obstacle, but another layer of complexity because you just had to take this into account.
Yeah, and just to give more of a sense of how these references are incorporated into the text, like there's so many sort of passing references to all of these Greek and Roman authors. So for example, Lucretius, there's references to Sappho's apples, Seneca's epistles, Horace. So he gives this wonderful sort of backstory of the phrase carpe diem and the characters involved, the setting, all of this. So it's a very sort of warm and personal approach to these ideas that we think of rather abstractly because they're so suffused throughout our culture. And through all these references, he imparts a kind of depth and historical richness to Ukrainian history, because all of the stories, or most of them at least, are set in the present, or at least begin in the present and then kind of peel away these layers of history, whether it's local history, whether it's global history, whether it's going all the way back to antiquity. And I thought if it's okay, I'd read a short quotation from one of the stories. And the story is called The Owl. And this gives a different sense of his meaning of antiquity. In this story, it's kind of a personal antiquity. So peeling back the layers of sort of his own life to find the meaning and connections between all of these objects that surround him and that younger generations might not understand the significance of. So at first, he starts describing the architecture of Lviv, which is the city where he lives now. So he says, Gothic, Romanesque, Baroque. As soon as evening takes to his conductor's stand, a flickering scale reverberates in the stone symphony of the old town. From the lowest do, like the sound of a squat gate on Virminska Street, to the highest la, hit by the Gothic windows on Knyazia Romana Street, where, as Paul Verlaine says, the sky is breathing down upon the roof. But most often, in the depths of my memory, I hear the windows that never lit up, not mansard windows, but attic ones, and not in the city, but in my father's home in Viriz. This was an old brick house inhabited by a succession of village priests and their families. I guess I must have done less damage to the stairs of my current place than to those old stairs that I've shuffled up countless times in my thoughts. But do steps taken in one's mind have any weight at all? Is it possible to wear down that which no longer exists? The parish office was long ago converted into a school, and from the old building, only the brick walls were kept. And so from there, he sort of travels through his memory up into this attic where all these old objects are stored, and there's a wonderful sort of catalog of all of these old objects that to a young person would look like junk. So, for example, rotten kind of parasols, all kinds of toys, a little whirligig, a glass cupola, different art and implements, tools that people no longer understand the uses of. And finally, this dead carcass of an owl, actually. So anyway, through all of these objects, I think he kind of traces a personal antiquity in his life. And that continues in the book in other ways, sort of like this literal vision of antiquity and personal antiquity.
No, this is great. And if I may just kind of jump in here for a second, give another example, which I think is a fantastic example of how, Greek and Roman antiquity comes through in his stories. So as Sabrina just stated, one of the stories is actually entitled Carpe Diem, which is this famous kind of maxim that you know, is popular today, and many people know about it, although they don't know like where it came from and, you know, the context behind it and the history behind it. But everybody kind of understands that this is like about seizing the moment, catching the day, seizing the moment. When you start, it actually, so the phrase comes from Horace's ode to Leuconoe. And when you start researching this, you will find several, and I don't want to say many, but probably even many English translations of the ode. And many translators interpreted it differently, and you would encounter all sorts of versions like catch the day and harvest the day and pluck the day and all sorts of different variations. Interestingly, so the Mora translated the ode twice, once as a young man, and back then he stuck to this traditional kind of understanding of like, you know, enjoy life now, don't wait, don't dwell in the past, don't think too much, don't worry too much about the future, enjoy it now, like now is the moment. And in that story that Sotomora is doing, Horace, he's actually imagining Horace, the fictional character, who's sitting on the shore, on the beach with Leuconoe, and they're enjoying a glass of wine, and Leuconoe is worried about the past and the future, and you know, she's into horoscopes and whatnot. And he's like, hey, like, be with me in this moment. And there's even like subtle erotic implications of whatnot, although Sotomora is kind of very modest about it. But then interestingly, you still have to deal on a linguistic level. You still have to deal with that phrase carpe diem. And what Sotomora does, he actually retranslates Horace's ode more recently. I don't have the date, but, you know, a couple of decades down the road. And as a different man, and a different translator probably as well, his interpretation changes. So all of a sudden, in Ukrainian, he's not saying something along the lines of like, catch the day or seize the day. He's saying something like, waste not a day, which is kind of, you know, uncannily reminiscent of Goethe's Faust, but let's not go there. So, and this waste not a day, and I'm trying to do a more or less verbatim version from Ukrainian, you all of a sudden you realize that now a much older Sotomora, a much more mature Sotomora, is no longer about this kind of delight and hedonism and whatnot, you know, the more classical traditional interpretation of the phrase. But now all of a sudden it's about waste not a day, like worry about your legacy, work hard. So to me personally, it's about like work ethic or what are you going to leave for posterity, you know? And then the whole story all of a sudden acquires a totally different vibe. So it's no longer like, oh, let's have a glass of wine and, you know, have a good time. All of a sudden, it's different. Even more, you know, problematic than that, which is, I think, a handful already. But even more problematic is the fact that in the story, so the Sotomora also keeps insisting on the importance of what I'm going to refer to as a soundscape, which is pretty much like, think of it as the sound of things. So for him, it's not just the meaning of that phrase, and this kind of harkens back to this important dichotomy in translation studies between form and content. All of a sudden, Well, so the more it's also about how this phrase sounds. And he comes up with a super complicated concept of this choriamp, which is like a combination of trochee and iambus in the same line. So tada, tada. So for him, that rhythm is also important. And then for Samrita and me, it's like, how do you even start, you know, wrapping your head around the complexity of this? Because the meaning is already quite complicated, but now it's like we also need to capture the sound of it, like waste not a day, because he now he's like listening to the waves beating that rhythm. He's listening. His lyrical protagonist is listening to the sea, and now the sound of that becomes important too. And you know, when you ask us about like what's untranslatable, well, things of that caliber are pretty much untranslatable,
right? So when we talk about antiquity, we also talk about war, right? And Ukraine had found itself embroiled in a war in the last 2 years. So, you know, what is the significance of this book in context of Ukraine's current literary and academic networks, as well as, you know, how the world may perceive the world, how the world may perceive Ukraine at the moment? So, like, where is the book placed? From these two perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So this is actually a project that we began before the war started, although, of course, there were already tensions arising. And since the war began, there has been kind of an efflorescence of translation from Ukrainian, and that's wonderful. However, I think this book is different from a lot of the other literature that is being brought to English-speaking audiences because it is not explicitly about the war. So I think there has been a tendency, especially in the West, to search out works that are very political and that take a very strong stance one way or another. And this book really deals very obliquely only with the themes of war, although it does come up in a couple of stories. For example, a beautiful story called The Garden, which traces the effects of World War II on sort of the village where Sedomora grew up, and the kind of loss of innocence of this beautiful garden that he remembers in childhood because of these tanks that rolled in and knock down all the beautiful apple trees that he remembers. But actually, for that reason, I think it is such an important book because it gives a much broader vision of Ukrainian culture and a much more sort of worldly, cosmopolitan view that is not only contingent on Ukraine's relationship with Russia. And in fact, it's very little contingent on it at all. Like, reading this book, you would hardly know that Ukraine is nearer to Russia. And even though much of this book sort of is drawn from the Soviet period, you would hardly know that the material exists within that historical framework because it draws so much from world literature. So all kinds of authors from Paul Verlaine to Gabriel Garcia Lorca and from antiquity. So all these authors that we've talked about, it gives such a rich sense of Ukrainian literary history, so naming all of these different Ukrainian poets and writers like Taras Shevchenko, and also Ukraine's rich tradition of literary translation. So translators also get sort of included in this meta history, I guess you could call it. And it also gives a very strong sense of Ukraine's pre-Soviet ties to Europe. So it gives a much different sense of Ukraine than what you draw from a lot of this literature that focuses solely on the relationship of Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah, I really love how Sabrina put it so eloquently. This kind of European side of Sotomayor's fiction and his, and again, it's kind of rooted in antiquity, I would say. Not to belabor the antiquity part, but it does come from there. But also Sotomayor is kind of, you can sense that nostalgia in all of his writing for this kind of pre-Soviet Ukraine. And even though it was also colonized by other empires, but these empires were slightly, and these other powers were slightly more tolerant towards all things Ukrainian than the Russian Empire was. And so when you, in many stories, you even see this kind of, it's reflected in the multilingualism of the stories. So you also, besides, you know, Greek and Latin, you also encounter German, which was the language of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And this is where, you know, the part of the country where Sodomora and I happen to come from in far western Ukraine. You can see Polish because Ukraine, that part of Ukraine was also under Polish rule for some time in the past. And so this nostalgia for these memories, you know, and trying to recollect the memories is there. As Sabrina said, and I totally agree, there's not much about war explicitly in the stories. But in some interviews and some of the latest interviews that Sodomora gave, he apparently addressed the war. In fact, he's still, despite his very respectable age, he writes prolifically. In fact, he contributes his op-ed pieces, or I don't know how to call them in English, like in Ukrainian they call it a column, like he contributes like a blog kind of thing an important Ukrainian portal. And there he does talk about the war. And one thing that he says is that the war, despite all of the horrors, and in fact, you know, I would say that, you know, this is a genocidal war. There's all signs. It's hard to prove in court of law, or in international court of law, I should say. But there's all signs that this is Russia's yet another genocidal war against Ukraine. So the Sodomora sees all of these horrors and he recognizes them. But he also says that this war is an opportunity for Ukrainians to see themselves differently, no longer as an imperial subject, but to see the value of their language and the value of their culture. And that's why, again, kind of to go back to this point I made about collaboration with Sabrina, surprisingly, I think that she felt the Europeanness of Sodomora's writing even more than I did, although, like, you know, I was born there. She was born in the United States. But this outsider's look gave her that insight, you know, that outsider's perspective. But for Sodomora, you know, like, Ukrainians need to go back to their own roots, to their own language, to their own culture, and to relearn how to appreciate it more. Because after this Russian domination and, you know, almost 400 years of Russian colonial rule, Ukrainians were almost brainwashed into thinking of themselves as inferior and so on. And interestingly, Sodomora doesn't just tell us to do this. It's not like, oh, I advise you to, you know, respect your language more. He does this. He performs this. So his fiction is performative in that way. And it kind of brings me to another untranslatable in his writing. I have a very strong feeling, as a native speaker of Ukrainian, that Sodomora teaches other Ukrainians Ukrainian, which may seem counterintuitive. And if you said this in English, you know, readers probably don't go to literature to learn the language, or at least that's not their first priority when you read literature, right? But Sodomora is actually digging up all sorts of fantastic things in Ukrainian to illustrate to his original readers who can read this in Ukrainian that, you know, Ukrainian is so rich. This is such a rich language. It doesn't have to be, you know, a dialect, or it doesn't have to be seen as something secondary, or you know, all of these other ridiculous imperial narratives. And so in translation, it's like I felt as a student, in fact, because when I read this, I would often say to Sabrina, hey, I understand what it means. But the, all the registers, all the nuances, you know, even the word smiles in the title. So the book is entitled The Tears and Smiles of Things. But even for the word smile, which is such a simple and, you know, straightforward word, Sodomora uses something of a higher register, something that is not used in everyday Ukrainian. So he says usmich, rechei, not usmishka, but usmi, which is a trickier word. So, you know, and this is what he's trying to do with his fiction, like to teach Ukrainian, which is something that, ironically, translation cannot capture. This is one feature of the whole of his whole project that is just impossible to convey in translation.
That sounds really fascinating. So what are you working on next?
Sabrina, you go ahead, because you probably have a translation project unlike me.
I do. So currently I'm working on a wonderful novel translated from Russian by Semyon Lipkin, who was a Russian Jewish translator in the Soviet Union. So one of the most prolific translators of the literatures of the non-Russian peoples of the Soviet Union, especially the Persianate and Turkic-speaking cultures, so Central Asians and people from the Caucasus. It's a fictional narrative of Stalin's deportation of these ethnic minorities and then their return to their homelands under Khrushchev, like after Stalin's death. So that's really fascinating. And it's another sort of meta narrative about translation, since the author was himself a translator and there are translator characters in the book. So in that way, it's kind of similar to Sadamora. I guess I'm drawn to these translator characters. And then I'm also working on my dissertation, which is about Soviet Central Asian literature. And it also incorporates translation. It looks at how Central Asian authors sort of use the models of Russian writers, but also foreign writers, and then infuse them with their own cultural values and narrative to kind of create their own versions of Soviet literature locally. And then I also have some Uzbek projects going, including some short stories by a contemporary Uzbek writer named Salamat Vafo. I'm excited to be translating a woman writer from Uzbekistan, since it is such a male-dominated literary scene.
Yeah, it looks like Sabrina, that's my turn. Looks like Sabrina has two full plates. I honestly, I feel like I need a break from doing literary translation. This has been a fascinating project. It took several years, and it's been exhausting. It's been exhausting. So the Mora just got the books. So if he likes it, although I'm not sure how much he can actually read it in English, but I already heard back from him just very recently, actually, like a few days ago. In fact, from the mediator between us and Sodomora, and he said that Sodomora actually liked the book very much, like the cover and the aesthetic side of it. But so I'm not sure if you know, but he's writing more stories. I was like, maybe after a little break, I will be back trying, because believe it or not, like I thought that the smiles and the tears of things would be it. So it's like a little sequel. So in Ukrainian, it's two different books, actually. So the first one about, you know, the tears are about, you know, slightly more nostalgic and sad things in life. But the smiles are more about his childhood. But now the third one just came out, I think 2022 or 2023, maybe 23, I guess. So it was called The Memory of Things. So the guy just can't stop. I mean, he's so phenomenally prolific. So maybe that'll be my future project. Right now, I'm trying to finish up the long overdue book monograph on transmises, which is a concept that stands for the fictional portrayal of translator characters, but also of translation, both as process and product in fictional works. And at first, I wanted to make it more broadly Slavic, but I think now I'm narrowing things down to just focus on Ukrainian literature, because I think Ukrainians have been the subaltern who can speak and should speak. So I want to give more voice to them, because more has been written about, you know, other Slavic literature. So I want to focus solely on Ukrainian. So this is the project that I'm trying to finish right now.
Right. So thank you so much, Roman and Sabrina, for joining us today. Very much good luck for this book, and I look forward to your future work.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
Goodbye.